Hey, everybody. It's Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It is always a pleasure to have you in the house with me. What a week. What a time. Lots going on in the world. We've got COVID kind of getting pushed back by the vaccine. We've got the Chauvin trial underway. We've got, of course, infrastructure. It's infrastructure week again. Wow. Who knew? Here we are yet again. But I'm glad you guys can join us. You know, it's always fun when you come on board with us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your downloads. We love it when you do that and do it all the time. So I got my buddy back. You know, we like to do the Steele and Unger routine as often as we can, and it's always great when my buddy Rick Unger, who is himself the host of the Rick Unger Show, a nationally syndicated two-hour political and news commentary radio show, which we invite you to check out. He is a progressive who has made his mark in radio and television by being willing to mix it up with anyone, including me. Including me. Can you believe that?
So, Michael, I'm going to need a minute. I'm on the phone with Matt Gaetz, and he's giving me his Black Book phone numbers. So
let me just get the rest of these. You know what? You go.
We're ahead up to have, the 14-year-olds.
You go ahead and have that conversation, and I'll call the police. Rick, welcome to the program, man.
It's good to be back, as always.
Yes, yes. You know, you're just out there doing your thing, man. It's always fun.
Are we going to talk about your Easter bonnet for this year?
Yeah. You know what? What's funny? I haven't really planned for that. I've got to do that.
You haven't connected to Easter yet.
No. It's Holy Week.
A few days away. You see, you need your Jewish friend to explain these things.
I know, right? Yeah. I'm looking forward to services tonight, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday. But
wow.
You go
tonight, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday?
Yeah, well, it's a tenebrae service that's done. Some churches do it. Some may not. Some will use it as part of the ceremonies on Thursday and Friday.
All I have to look forward to is a really good lunch at my daughter's on Sunday.
We'll see. There you go. Yeah. I'm going to try to be a good Catholic boy for the next few days as we head into the holiest time of the year in the Catholic tradition, and that is Easter. So I'm looking forward to it. And I'm glad I'm talking to my Jewish friend because, you know, we're simpatico, you know?
That's right.
You know, we're cousins religiously.
We are brothers from another mother.
All right, so this is clearly getting crazy. So there's a lot that we can tap into. So I just want to step back because you like to do crime detective work and sort of look at these things from both a legal and sort of political perspective. What's your take on the Chauvin trial so far as it's opened up with the witnesses who I think have been making some compelling storylines for the country, particularly juxtaposed up against the videos. So you then begin to hear some of the backstories. What's your take right now?
Well, I mean, so far, I think the prosecution has done a particularly good job. I've seen a few mistakes that the defense has made. They should probably figure that out by now. Got to tell you, it's obviously way too early to form anything of a serious opinion because we're still in the prosecution's case. We haven't gotten to the defense case.
Right.
I will complain, though, about one thing. You know, this hasn't been reported enough. The judge changed a ruling that really upset me. If you go back to the end of last year, the defense had made a request that evidence of a prior arrest of George Floyd that took place in 2019 be admitted into court. Their reason was this. They were arguing that Floyd purposely, in that arrest, when he got busted, he took the pills that he had in his possession, he swallowed them. So along come the paramedics, because his blood pressure is going way up, they go, hey, you're going to have a stroke, man. They take him to the hospital instead of to jail, and nobody ever filed any charges. So the defense attorneys here were trying to argue, well, he probably did the same thing again. He figured he'd swallow the pills, he'd end up at the hospital, and he'd never have to face charges. Well, the judge said, come on, that's just not in any way evidentiary of what this particular police officer might have done. Now, get this. In December, two cars, they had searched George Floyd's car on the day of the death. They had searched the police squad car. You remember, right, he was first put into a police squad car to see if there were any drugs. These were experienced police teams who did these searches. They did not find drugs in either vehicle, not in George Floyd's car and not in the police squad car. In December, the defense attorneys asked for a re-examination of those cars. And lo and behold,
they found drugs
in both. Not only did they miss the drugs somehow in George Floyd's car, mysteriously, they found them also in the police car.
Planned much?
Yeah. I mean, come on. So based on that, the judge changed his ruling is going to admit that evidence of the prior arrest. And I was just stunned beyond belief. And the attorney general's office isn't pushing it because it's another branch of government. They'd have to be attacking the organization that holds those vehicles. If he gets off because of that evidence, and we'll never really know because it's going to influence the jury, this is just an absolutely unbelievable miscarriage.
Well, I don't know what George Floyd's prior criminal record, or whether or not he had drugs on him the last time he was arrested, has to do with the behavior and actions of Officer Chauvin.
Absolutely none.
Who, by all evidence as presented so far, and unless they have a videotape of George Floyd showing his ass and acting a fool and being violent, I'll get into this, black man, angry black man crazy in a moment, then I have no idea. To me, it makes no sense.
The problem is no reason why
that evidence should be introduced.
Of course
because
not.
It is not relevant to the fact that you killed a man deliberately.
Right. That's right. And you know as well as I know, we're both lawyers, that it only takes one juror to be impressed with that. Oh, I see what this guy was up to. And all of a sudden they defocus from the fact that George Floyd is not on trial here. The officer's on trial here, and it has an impact. It only takes one out of the 12. This was a terrible, terrible ruling by the judge, unbelievably bad. I mean, how could those drugs have been there when they first searched both cars?
But not only that, Rick, especially given that the fact that George Floyd died and the ensuing reaction by the public to that death in May, not in December, but in May, would have, I thought, required a detailed review and examination of the evidence, those two vehicles, because those police vehicles would be evidence at that point.
Sure.
To see if, in fact, that theory could bear itself out. You don't then come 5-6 months later, do another review and say, look what we found in the back seat.
Now, both of these cars, I mean, the police department has had the chain of evidence. They've had the cars right since the day it all happened, both the squad car and the Floyd car. Nobody else was near those cars except the police department who had control.
So do you think the prosecutor chews that up and spits it out?
I don't know. The prosecutor should have challenged it back in December. As I said, I think there's a concern here because, you know, state organizations, you have been in a state organization. State organizations don't like to go to war with other state organizations. And I think the attorney general's office, which is prosecuting this case, might have had some trepidation after accusing the police of planting drugs.
Well, they did.
Well, of course they did.
I mean, it makes no sense. So, yeah, then brings me to the next piece, which is the defense creating this scenario about Black people generally, that somehow the police were threatened by the crowd. But all the evidence I have seen shows the police, particularly that police officer Tao, I believe his name is, pushing and shoving the crowd, which are just standing there. Now,
listen, you can't criticize.
We're going to run our mouths. We're going to run our mouths. Black folks, especially in a scene like that, we're going to just like going to a movie theater, right? We're going to commentate on the action that's in front of us, right?
It's Black people and my wife.
Right. We're going to say something. So what are they? I mean, saying something is not the same as hindering the investigation or trying to prevent the arrest of an individual, in which case, yes, I could see officers wanting to push people back and create a perimeter. If they were that threatened, Rick, you create the perimeter. You seal off that area and you push people back behind a police line that may be a half a block wide, around. But that wasn't the case here. So it's just this whole idea that suddenly you get in that environment. I mean, like, how long have you been a police officer in this community? And you're suddenly afraid of Black folks who are standing on the side of a street looking at you do what you're doing and saying something that's never happened to you before. And this idea that suddenly we're violent people is just such an annoying trope to throw out, that this six foot four black man is dangerous and the people in the crowd are dangerous.
As a white man, I have to say I'm terrified every time I'm in your presence. So I can relate. Now look, I mean, and if there's anything everybody can agree on, these were not police officers who were afraid to arrest somebody or do anything. If anybody had actually obstructed their efforts, they'd have been cuffed, thrown in another car. It's silly. But these are things that I think are easily brought out. These are things that I don't worry so much about. If anything, the jury is going to look at that and go, oh, please,
But what the problem is, and that's fine. And so there is, you rightly separate the trial from the rest of us, the society as a whole. But what I think is most annoying to a hell of a lot of Black people in listening the last couple of days to this defense attorney lay out this bullshit about characterizing the behavior of a Black man who, by the way, they have handcuffed.
Exactly.
Okay. And so it's not like a situation they came across an individual who was high on PCP. That individual, that's a whole different kind of arrest, because PCP does something physiologically to people that, first off, it makes them really hot, so they strip to be buck naked, number one. Number two, they have an enormous amount of strength. That was not the situation here. But the reality of it is, to go off and try to treat whether he was high on drugs that he had used earlier in the day or not, but to go and put these tropes in play really just furthers the stereotype of, for white America to be afraid of Black people in certain circumstances, and in most cases, all the time.
But I'll tell you what, reapplying it to the trial, this line was one of the mistakes I thought the defense attorneys made. I believe there's three Black members of the jury. Now, I promise you, if you've ever done anything in a courtroom, the rest of the jury, they may not listen to those three Black members. They may not give them, they may not make one of them the foreman. But I'll tell you what, those three jurors are going to be treated with kid gloves in a case like this by the remaining jury. And if one of them picked up on everything you're just saying, they are going to be able to force the white jurors to understand that. I thought it was, I mean, there have been a couple of lines of questioning where the defense has gone, where I've scratched my head and thought, you're supposed to be better than this.
Well, one of those was with Darnella Frazier.
Yes.
Where they just, just basically opened the door and said, okay, sure go in and make the case against us.
Yes. And you know what? That's exactly what they did, because they opened the door to the, you know, recross that would not have been there. And she killed him. She killed him on the recross examination.
Yeah.
So,
you never ask a person like that in a situation like that after witnessing what they did. Well, how did that make you feel?
Unless you know what the answer is going to be and it works for you.
Thank you. And so there are clearly some early miscues by the defense in terms of trying to establish a narrative in favor of their client. And certainly the witnesses, even the more reluctant witness who was on yesterday, the young woman. We'll get to her in a minute.
Oh, you mean the woman who worked at the Safeway store or whatever?
Yeah. And who didn't even really, I mean, it's obvious a lot of these folks don't want to be there. Exactly. We understand that. Yeah. But though she was just like not even in the room, she did not want to be there. And that's fine. We understand that. But even in those situations, they were still affirming what we witnessed with the videotape, but also affirming the narratives that this individual was abused by the police in a way that went beyond police procedure. And so I think that's going to be an interesting sort of tell. But then, of course, you've got she's a firefighter, or
she's a firefighter. And she has been by far the most persuasive witness. And there have been some very persuasive witnesses. But boy, I was listening to her testimony and going, this jury, they cannot in any way, shape or form not buy into what she's saying.
Yeah. Do you think she hurt herself with her sort of personalizing? I mean, she got into it with the judge. And
Yeah. There was some attitude. And I thought at one point that it might hurt her. But I just think, you know, listen, the attitude fades a little bit. She's at the beginning, right, of the presentations. By the time the jury gets into that jury room, whatever attitude she had will have faded. It may not be gone completely, but it will have faded in the jury's mind. And what won't fade is when they read back the transcript and see what she said.
Yeah. That's the thing. Whether you and I can appreciate at one level, I do appreciate her attitude, because what comes across to me is the fact that a lot of these witnesses talk about how they have been personally impacted.
Yes.
You know, the young man who said, I feel guilty.
Yes.
I should have done more. Or the gentleman who was on today, earlier today, talking about who was the store employee at the cup shop, that, you know, he felt bad. I never should have brought up the $20 bill, made that an issue for the employer. Because he even said, I tried to tell my employee, look, here, I'll give you the 20. Don't worry about it.
Right.
And so now he, you know, you can see how people were emotionally invested in what ultimately happened and the impact that it had on them, and why I probably for many of them, if not all of them, it was been so difficult to sit on that stand.
No, yeah, I mean, the kid you were talking about today, I mean, he's obviously a really good kid. But, you know, I kept reminding myself that, you know what, this is all irrelevant. This is all actually irrelevant.
Right.
Everything that kid had to say about the $20 bill. What if George Floyd did know that he was passing a bad $20 bill?
Right. I mean,
if you listen to it today, you kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, maybe he didn't know. But what if he did?
Right.
What if he did? That's no justification to be murdered. So what? What if he passed $10,000 in phony bills? That is not a justification in the United States of America to be murdered.
So that seems to be the thing that really is the kicker here, is this the fact that And which is why I think a lot of us have our hair up on end, which for me is saying something since I have no hair, about trying to make George, put George Floyd on trial.
Well, that's what's happening. And that's what's going to happen even more as we get to the other side of this trial. It's all going to be about putting George Floyd on trial.
Yeah. How do you think that plays?
Hard to say. You know, this is the problem, and this is the problem with juries, frankly. It can play. It can. It's a lot of it has to do with, you know, if I were the prosecutor in this, every single time the defense attorney offered up evidence that does put George Floyd on trial, I would be coming in up on cross-examination, and I would be saying to that witness, I only have one question for you. Is anything you just testified to a justification for murder? It's my only question. And I would do that with every single person. Obviously, there may be some I might try to discredit if I think they're lying, but that is the point that they have to be able to drive home to this jury. You can prove that George Floyd is one of the worst human beings that ever, ever lived. Go ahead. Has nothing to do with why this officer murdered him.
Right, right. Yeah, well, on Earth 2, that's how the criminal justice system
works. Well, that's right. That's the problem. Here on Earth 1, here, not so much.
Here where we are, yeah, he's a black man. He's guilty. Yeah. So, but the black man isn't on trial. Doesn't matter.
He's guilty.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're having a great conversation with our buddy Rick. Because, Rick, when I come back, I want to stay on the judiciary for a little bit and talk about Joe Biden's 11 judicial nominees. We'll have more with our buddy Rick Unger right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, buddy, welcome back. We're talking to the incomparable Rick Unger. You know him, star of stage, screen, and just basically running his mouth.
Mostly just running his mouth.
Mostly just running his mouth. Rick is the host of The Rick Unger Show. Catch him. He's nationally syndicated. So, Rick, the president has put before the appropriate figures on Capitol Hill who judge such things, 11 candidates for the judiciary. They are 9 women and 2 men. They are of Muslim, Asian American, Pacific Islander, and African or Black descent. What's your take? How do you look at this first round of nominees that he's putting out there, particularly given that we're talking, you know, we were just talking about the judiciary and the judicial system and, you know, the judge, not that it matters, but the judge in this Chauvin case is a white judge, older white gentleman, seems fair. So no commentary other than noting that relative to
I'm not going to agree he seems fair based on what I said at the beginning.
That one piece notwithstanding, I understand your point there, but I've only had less than a week to really judge what his jurisprudence is going to be in a matter like this. But when you look at, you know, what President Trump, his nominees for the bench were versus how Joe Biden is rolling out his. What do you think?
Well, I have to acknowledge at the outset, and I know you know this about me, I get a little Pollyanna-ish when it comes to the court. Mm-hmm. I don't think and I don't believe and I don't like. I recognize that it exists, but I don't like political influences on appointing judges. You have to understand what a judge's job is. And a judge that is, especially at the federal district court level, a little bit different when we get to the appellate levels, but that judge only has one job, and that is to be the referee and to referee based on the law. Right. So it should not make a whit of difference to me if that judge is appointed by a Donald Trump or appointed by a Joe Biden. Now, the problem with Donald Trump's appointments, and I have to tell you, I was surprised that there were any openings to fill, because Trump went so, you know, hell-bent towards filling every judicial seat he could.
Right.
The problem that I had in most instances with the Trump appointees wasn't that they would have a conservative bend. It was that they were incompetent. There were so many judges that he put on the bench that the American Bar Association said, what, are you kidding me? This person's never even been a trial lawyer. This person's never been in court. They're a contract lawyer. They settle disagreements, and you're making them a federal judge. That's a bad idea. Now, I honestly don't know enough about these judges to know their history. I know a number of them are first-time judges.
Right.
So, you know, to me, I care about how well do they understand the law? How good are they at understanding when they're being BS'd by any of the attorneys in front of them? The politics should never play a role. So it remains to be seen. It's nice to see people who are minorities get some of these positions, because for too long they've been shut out of it. But at the end of the day, what I care about is, I don't care if they're purple, black, green, or orange, how good are they going to be as a jurist?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. The oldest nominee is 57.
Yeah.
The youngest is 39.
They're going to be there a while.
The youngest is 39. So they will look to be there and be groomed to move to, as you referenced before, the appellate level and maybe perhaps beyond. I think that there is much more of a concerted effort to bring a great deal more parity. I think, notwithstanding what you said about their qualifications, which are paramount and most important to every defendant and claimant that comes before a judge, that they do have blinders on with respect to the politics, the race, and the other things. But one cannot also help but appreciate the fact that, at least in this moment, there is a great deal of attention being paid to the composition of our judiciary.
No question.
And that that there is a need, particularly after the current the run of the last of the former guy, to stack the bench, if you will, to see the kinds of jurors that are being selected. You know, it makes it much more interesting, and particularly for how this plays itself out downstream, to know that you now have the process of grooming judges, minority judges, if you will, for elevation.
Those higher courts. Yeah.
Right.
I agree.
Yeah.
What I found so fascinating, Michael, about the entire big lie thing we went through, a number of the judges who ruled the correct way were Trump-appointed judges.
Right,
and all that did was remind me that judges, and again, this is where I get a little Pollyanna-ish, judges by and large will perform the responsibility of a judge once they're on the court. Donald Trump never understood that. He actually believed that in making these appointments to the Supreme Court, they were going to be there for him when he needed them. And that was never going to be the case. Forget their politics, forget their conservatism. At the end of the day, when you put on the robes of a Supreme Court justice, I may think you're wrong about something, but, you know, in terms of your interpretation of law, but by and large, they act as judges.
Which is why I believe, you know, those seminal cases like Roe versus Wade do not get overturned by this conservative court, because if they are true to their belief in stare decisis, precedent, et cetera, then unless there is and I know there are a number of states that are working on compelling legislation or compelling cases to around abortion, as we've just seen states now outright ban abortion, that they're trying to force this issue in front of this court. I still believe that, you know, the jurisprudence that you've just described leads me to believe, Rick, that they're going to appreciate the precedent.
Now, you understand that our old friend Eric Siegel, who is a constitutional law professor down at Georgia State, who used to come on our show all the time, he thinks that everything you and I are saying right now is absolute rubbish. He does believe that the Supreme Court is wholly a political organization.
Yeah, but yeah, maybe I have to get, maybe I'll get our buddy back on with the three, with the both of us, and we can have that round of conversation, because, you know, I can see the argument for that. And I mean, throughout its history, I mean, I totally get it. And it's not just the Supreme Court. Then you would apply that to every court, every bench, right? Every right. judge.
It just matters more when it's the Supreme Court.
No, it doesn't.
No, maybe not.
It matters more downstream, baby, because you know how much stuff doesn't get to the Supreme Court.
That's fair. That's fair. I will concede that point.
It kind of matters on the front end. That's something for us to keep an eye on and watch how the president sort of plans out his judicial strategy, particularly in the face of some of the cases that we think are going to be popping up over the next few months. And certainly one of those will have both a judicial and legislative impact, and that's gun reform. In the wake of the killing of 8 civilians, Asian American, mostly women, in Georgia recently, as well as the mass shooting, what was that, a couple of days later?
Yeah.
The issue of gun control is back on the forefront, you know, yet again in Colorado and Boulder, where a gentleman kills 10 people 2 days after we saw what happened in Georgia. The president has come out and reiterated his support for legislation that will expand background checks and ban assault weapons. And you know, that, of course, stirs that pot, as, you know, it is wont to do. And for a lot of the prevention advocates, those folks are out there kind of, you know, saying, we actually got to do something about this.
They say that every time.
That's just the point. They say, look, we've been saying this since Sandy Hook. We've actually been saying it since Columbine, for God's sake. Where do you land on this issue? How do you see it kind of working its way into the public psyche again? Are we numb to it, or does this take on a different flavor given that attitudes seem to have changed along the way on this issue?
Well, to answer your last question, no. To answer the first question, I would probably say that this issue is always in the public psyche. I don't remember a time when it's ever gone away, but I unfortunately always come back to the same conclusion. We watch 20 plus adorable little children, and I mean children, 5 years old, 6 years old, get gunned down while they were at school, and nobody did anything about it.
And did nothing.
So why in the world do we, and every time it's happened since, whenever, you know, Las Vegas comes to mind, all of these shootings, and we all start with the discussion again, and it goes absolutely nowhere.
Why is that?
Because,
why is that in your view?
At one time I would have said it was the power of the NRA. I don't think I'm going to say that at this point. I think it's a simple matter of this. There are millions of people in this country who are gun owners. And this is where I put a little bit, if not a lot, of the blame on my side, on the progressive side. And I know it drives them nuts when I say that. But the reality is, if you can't understand that owning a gun for many, many, many Americans is part of their ethic, it's part of their culture. Almost all of these people got their first gun from their grandfather, who handed it down to them. It's not about using the gun to shoot anything. I got this from my grandfather. It's precious to me. This is a part of the culture. And we have always approached this by saying, you know what, if you're a gun owner or if you support gun rights, Second Amendment rights, you are clearly a bad person. Well, they're not bad people. They're not even a little bit bad people. Yes, there are some bad guys out there who get their hands on guns. But until this side of the argument can come to the discussion by saying, we know you're not bad people. Right. We understand why guns are important to you, whether it be for protection or cultural purposes. And we're going to go into the conversation with that in mind. Now, we will move in that direction because we should, if you can move in that direction.
How do you balance?
Here's the weird part, though. The gun owners in this country have moved. They have moved. Look at any poll, and you will see a huge percentage of Americans, and that has to include gun owners, who are totally cool with some of these common sense things we could do to just maybe have an impact. Politicians won't let them.
How do you reconcile the state versus federal issues there that do exist in this space, where you have a lot of states that are, you know, have already in place,
yes,
fairly stringent gun laws.
Yes.
And of course, you know, the federal capacity to really do anything about that is limited because of the 10th Amendment issues that some folks like to raise, you know, sure, states' rights, et cetera. Is that the stalemate? That's why this kind of dies on the vine. But we did see movement after the shooting in Florida with Douglas Stoneman High School.
Yes, yes.
So we did see the at the state level, those students able to move some legislation there. But outside of that real movement, to your point about how how gun owners, and a lot of whom are NRA members, have moved on this issue, it just doesn't seem to go anywhere. We just don't care. We just figure, all right, well, we'll just be outraged the next time someone gets shot.
It all comes down to the politicians. I don't see a big conflict problem between state and federal because, and it's kind of interesting, if you go to the real hotbeds of gun problems, and I would always say Chicago is at the top of that list.
My goodness,
70, 80 people every weekend. Illinois has some of the strongest gun regulation laws in the nation. Those guns are not originating in Illinois. They're originating in surrounding states that are very easy to get to and bring guns in. That, I think, gives the feds all the power they need. You've got a very strong interstate commerce argument there that you can use to regulate guns. That's not really the problem. The problem is politicians, whether it is correct or not, I'm not even convinced that they need to feel this way or think this way any longer. They do, or at least enough of them do, worry that they will blow themselves up with their constituents if they even put a foot forward in the direction of gun regulation. And you know better than I know, there's only one thing that controls what a politician does. Will I keep my phony baloney job in the next election?
Well, who the hell are we talking about, Rick? It blow themselves up with their constituents. Their constituents want the reform.
They don't believe it.
I mean, this is a 90% issue.
I hear you, but they don't believe it. They are convinced.
How do you not believe a 90% poll? I mean, wait a minute. You mean to tell me you can go out and believe that, you know, Donald Trump won the election in 2020, but you can't believe 90% of the people when they tell you, say, we want gun reform?
Well, I think I have your answer. If you can explain to me how 85% of the public here in this country supported the American Recovery Act and not one Republican voted for it, I don't think in either chamber, then if you can explain that, maybe you can explain the guns.
Okay.
They don't care.
It is just frustrating on so many levels to see
we
can't get the kinds of reforms in place. And look, you know, I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I have been. I don't own a gun, but, you know, I supported the right of citizens to own, although the way some white folks act, I think I'm going out and get one. the reality of it is, Rick, that we're watching the systematic killing of people, and we are shamefully hiding from doing anything about it, because we want to use the Second Amendment as a cudgel to prevent reform, and we want to use the Second Amendment as a cudgel to take extreme reform.
Just a codicil I want to add to the conversation. People need to keep this in mind, how easy it is to stop any kind of gun reform. All you need, forget the NRA, all you need are gun manufacturers making contributions to one person, Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Make those contributions, you stop the legislation. How is it possible we still can't get laws through on liability of gun manufacturers? Make contributions to Mitch McConnell. That's it. It's all you got to do. It's over. Well, that's not going to stop.
Okay. Well, that's depressing as hell.
It is depressing, isn't it?
So yeah, let's get into something that is not so much depressing, but it is, here we go again.
Andrew Cuomo?
Well, yeah, Andrew Cuomo would be one. Matt Gaetz, as you mentioned, would be another.
He'd be another.
He'd be another one. I'm not even going to deal with that stupid. Largely because, okay, we're still, this is a developing story on Gaetz. Right. But I find it, let's just say, a little bit suspicious.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, you'll get a kick out of this.
That he announces he's retiring to become a media star.
Exactly. You'll get a kick out of this. For our listeners who may not know, Michael and I share a producer. We have the same producer. Yeah. And I get a note from him yesterday and I had already seen the story about, I might go to Newsmax and whatever. And I sent a note back to him saying, somebody's caught him doing something. I won't say what I thought that he was caught doing. It turned out to be kind of the opposite. Okay. But I said, I don't want to do that story. Today, when we're planning tomorrow's show, I said, we got to do that story.
you got to do that story. He's going to get caught in his own lie. And the fact that he sits there and thinks, Tucker Carlson,
he caught himself 15 times.
Well, and not only that, but Tucker Carlson's response to it was hysterical. This is the weirdest interview I've ever done. Really, Tucker? That's the best? What, you're not defending your boy? You're not coming to bat for him? What? Oh, you got the word from Ojai at Fox? Oh, let's not get close to this because there's another story to drop? Yeah.
Yep.
Because you know how it is. The New York Times doesn't just do one story.
No, they do not. It is the beginning.
All right. So off of stupid, and let's get on to interesting. The Amazon is in an interesting little dance right now. There are efforts underway, as you know, and I know this is close to your political heart. To unionize nearly 6,000 workers for Amazon's plant in Alabama, and they've got this whole process going on right now, where the union is in an interesting kind of a different space, where they have this election that's coming up.
No, the election's actually over.
The election's over. That's right.
It ended in the last day of March. Now what you're going through the process of vote counting, which is a long process.
That's the process. How do you see that? How do you see that election going? Because it is being closely watched. I thought it was today, but I guess it was yesterday that started or
no, they finished. They've been voting for two months.
Right.
The original fight that Amazon put up was trying to stop them from being able to vote by mail. They lost that fight.
Where have we heard that before?
Where have we heard that before? They lost that fight. Voting by mail has been going on for 2 months. It ended on the last day of March, which was yesterday. But now, see, here's what people don't quite get about this. I honestly couldn't tell you if the workers will vote to unionize or not. I have absolutely no sense of it. But what I do know, even if they do vote to unionize, we're nowhere close to the end of this story. We are, in fact, just at the beginning, because Amazon will certainly know all of the tricks of the trade in terms of dragging out a collective bargaining agreement. There'll be trips to the NLRB. If the PRO Act doesn't pass, and even if it does pass, I have no idea if it's retroactive or not. The NLRB is the most toothless government organization truly ever created. They can slap Amazon on the hands and say, you're not bargaining in good faith. You're just trying to put this off. This comes all the way down to the question of what if at the end of the day, Amazon just says, you know what? We've kind of figured out that this is not the best place for a distribution center. We really would do much better if it was in Tennessee. Right. So we're going to shut down the Alabama center. Right. Yep. Put all those people that voted to unionize out of work. There are so many issues and so many questions that it can take as little as a couple of weeks and easily go as long as a couple of years.
Yeah. And I think the key thing for me, which is what I wanted to drill down on, is when you get into that, even with that initial collective bargaining, process, you and I know that that's not something that's done in a short period of time. No. It takes a great deal of effort, and it goes through a number of iterations before you even get close to what the parties agreed to. During that time, you then have the efforts that you just described, where the company, by and large, says, you know, We just can't sustain this operation any longer. Between all the efforts that and costs that are being sunk into setting up this, you know, this new process, and et cetera, we're just going to move on. How does that play for Amazon if it comes to something like that? Is this another one of those yawn moments because the unions have lost so much clout with the American people as a whole? Or does this reengage their interest in this era where we're trying to build back jobs in an economy that's been politely disrupted by COVID?
If I'm running Amazon, God forbid, you asked the right question, because on the one hand, I'm going to be saying, do I really care how the public feels about this? And on the other hand, I'm thinking I might really care about how the public feels about this. In terms of the legal position, you know, the NLRB is so toothless that they might actually be able to get away with it or get such a small fine, it wouldn't matter.
Right.
But let's be honest about Amazon. I will be honest about Amazon. I hate their employment practices. I appreciate that they pay their employees $15 an hour. I appreciate that a lot of them actually get medical care, but they treat them like absolute dog crap. It is an unsafe work environment, and I hate them. Ask me how many things I bought from Amazon this week, though.
That's the catch 22. They have become such an enterprise for everyday purposes.
That's it.
It is the ultimate one stop. I can get my groceries on Amazon now. I can do, you know, and have them delivered. And in addition to getting a new bicycle delivered to my son or getting these things that we need, they have become such.
Sure.
Is that kind of the reality of consumerism that has kind of taken hold in the last 50 years, that we have now become so much a creature of consumerism, the ease with which we can purchase, the ability to purchase whatever we want. And now we're looking at, you know, processes that I literally can go online and order something right now and have it delivered to my door in the next 3 hours, as opposed to waiting 3 days. Have we begun to turn a blind eye to the impact? When people hear, well, you're making $15 an hour.
What's your problem?
Joe down the street's not making $15 an hour.
Yeah, it depends on the product. I went through a phase, like I think a lot of Americans did, where I really worked hard to only buy American. We were going through a hard time, and I wanted to support our workers here. I didn't find that very difficult. But yet when it comes to Amazon, I am a complete hypocrite. And not only am I a complete hypocrite, everybody I know who's a mouthy progressive talking on TV and talking on the radio, when I ask them the question, they admit that they are too. We're all buying from Amazon.
So should they be broken up?
No, I don't see any reason for them to be broken up, but I would like to see.
A lot of your progressive friends think they should be.
I don't see it. I don't know why they deserve to be broken up for being hugely successful. But I do think we ought to be regulating to the point where they have to treat workers in accordance with how you're supposed to treat workers in this country. I'm not even saying pass new laws. Just do what OSHA says you ought to do, except OSHA doesn't ride herd over them. If they, I got no beef with what they're paying people now. I would like to see a little better in the area of healthcare benefits, but the problem there is not these things. The problem there is it is not safe or reasonable to work in an Amazon facility, which is why they have such a big turnover rate. I don't even think it's good for them, but I don't get to make that call. But it's not going to change unless we get this new law that puts some teeth into the NLRB. And if the workers there decide, I don't know what they're going to decide, to unionize or not. And if people like me continue to be a hypocrite.
So I got into a little hot water on Twitter.
No.
Yeah, it happens. this week, in responding to one Senator Elizabeth Warren, who to Amazon News, which basically said in their tweet, so that everybody understands the context, they had tweeted out you to Senator Warren, you make the tax laws, Senator Warren, we just follow them. If you don't like the laws you've created, by all means, change them. Right. Here are the facts. Amazon has paid billions of dollars in corporate taxes over the past few years alone. And they go on to talk about what they have done as corporate citizens. She then responded back, I didn't write the loopholes you exploit, Amazon. Your armies of lawyers and lobbyists did. But you bet I'll fight to make you pay your fair share and fight your union busting and fight to break up big tech so you're, quote, not powerful enough to heckle senators with snotty tweets. So that's all I needed to hear. So I had no problem with the first part of what she wrote. So I responded, Senator Warren, disagreement is not the same as heckling. You need to check yourself if you seek to silence critics of your decisions or actions as a senator. Regardless of your disdain for their, quote, snotty tweets, Amazon can tweet snot at you all day. Bring tissue, not cancel culture. Of course, the more liberal / progressive followers I have on Twitter was not too happy with me. I keep telling folks, y'all liked me when I was fighting for democracy and trying to take down Trump.
Now you don't like me.
You forget. I'm still a conservative, baby.
And people can get kind of imbalanced in this. Look, I mean, yes, Amazon is now paying taxes. They went a long time without paying any taxes. But then again, what everybody wants to forget, if you want to hate Amazon, they went an even longer time losing huge sums of money.
Yes,
they weren't making profits
when their balance sheet was upside down.
Right. Nobody cared. So you've got to be fair about it. Same thing with breaking them up. First of all, I honestly don't view Amazon, I know most do, as a tech company. I really don't. They may exist on the internet online, but to me, they are a retail company that sells a whole lot of products. So I think you got to be fair about this. Yes, I completely disagree with the way they handled this labor issue. You know what? There are probably stores I've been shopping in person, brick and mortar stores for years that also had those kinds of disagreements, but I never knew it. You got to keep a balance here.
But Rick, the point that I really wanted to take with the senator was, okay, fine, let's have a discussion about the taxes that the company pays or doesn't pay. Let's even have a conversation about what to do about big tech, since everyone seems to be, think that they're the bad guy. Okay, fine. But don't you dare take the position that you want to break up big tech so you're not powerful, so it's not powerful enough
to be nasty to Elizabeth Warren
or to criticize criticize you with snotty tweets. You damn Skippy, we're going to criticize your ass with snotty tweets when you do snotty stuff.
It certainly was not her best communication.
Yeah. And so, this arrogance of you know, power that we see, whether we're talking about, you know, what Elizabeth Warren is putting out there, or what we saw or what we see other members of Congress doing, because they think they can and they should somehow be protected from criticism because they have a title in front of their name. That's the stuff that I worry about the most.
It's funny you're talking about that now. Are you noticing this much more now than you used to? Because I am.
Noticing what?
This arrogance.
Oh, no, hell no.
I think it's always been there.
I wrote about this back in the 1990s.
Interesting.
It has always been there, and it has been a steady upward climb in the level of arrogance that politicians are prepared and willing to display because they think that they have the upper hand over the citizens. As I try to remind them, you still work for us because the Constitution says you do. And at the end of the day, we can fire you. The problem is not enough of us take that serious enough of a responsibility because we keep electing and reelecting these rat bastards who go on and do the same thing over and over again. And what do? We complain about the same thing they're doing over and over again.
And then we reelect them.
Yeah, you realize.
You're absolutely right. You're on the money on this. For whatever reason, I have been more sensitive to exactly what you're saying, but more recently. I don't know why. It makes sense that it's nothing new, and I completely believe you were writing about it back in the 90s. There is just something to me that is more in my face about this now.
Yeah, there is. There is. And it is, again, it is a protrusion that we have to cut off. it's like that growth that's on the side of your leg. And you're like, okay, now this can't stay. Doc, take it off. We have to perform that kind of surgery with our elected officials.
And yet, will we do it?
No.
No.
No. Right. No. 7 million people told us that in the last election.
Are we possibly the laziest country there is?
You got 7 million more people voting for the other guy than voted for him the first time around. You're like, oh, okay, shit. We see where this is going.
Seriously, what is this? We have some of the best productivity numbers. American people will go to work and work hard. They're not lazy. Right?
But we're lazy with our politics. We are lazy in our politics.
You ask them to just read some stuff, to learn something, and it just can't be done.
You and I've had this discussion before. The European system is almost, I won't say the reverse because they're not lazy professionally. No. I'm not saying that.
But they are the reverse on politics.
They are the reverse on politics. And I think it's because they have a parliamentary system, so they've got more ways to engage politically.
They are definitely into it.
And they're into
it. Now, there are a lot of Europeans who will sometimes adopt a side like what we see here, and not always for the best reasons, and they won't always be open to understanding when their side is right and wrong. Right. But they are aware of it, and they are engaged in it.
Well, Rick, we began on the streets.
Are we done already?
We're done, baby.
Oh, my God.
We began... on the streets of the inner city in a courtroom, and we ended up at a European capital. So this is how our conversation
that, that sounds good to me. I'm due for a Paris visit. I don't know, you know.
Rick Unger, it is always a special treat when you stop in the neighborhood to say hello and spend some time on the Michael Steele podcast. Thank you so much. Folks, don't forget to check out his nationally syndicated two-hour political and news commentary radio show, The Rick Unger Show. Check it out. It's good, smart conversation with a lot of very interesting folks. And certainly follow Rick on Twitter at Rick Unger.
UNGAR.
Yes, UNGAR, not ERAR. And until next time, y'all take it safe out there. Be good, be smart, wear the mask, and get the vaccine. Don't be stupid, okay? Get the vaccine. This ain't Florida. Come on. All right, everybody. I'll take care. Later.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.